Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and as it's Christmas, we don't have a live show this week. Instead, we hear for the next hour a unique scientist with an unpopular view about climate change. We all thought the BBC and the rest of the media's job was to present all sides of an argument so that we, the public, can decide whether we go along with what could be the first ever system of global taxation. That hasn't happened. Well-qualified and popular scientists who dispute the claim that mankind is entirely responsible for climate change have been shut out of the discussions. One such silenced voice we're about to hear used to be Britain's most popular scientist. With series like Bellamy's Britain, he's been honoured by universities around the world. So here he is.
David Bellamy.
Wow! Now, I've never really grown up, and wow is my favourite word. And whenever I go wow in certain places, I get told that I am politically incorrect. Not long ago, I was talking to the press about London, where I was born and lived for 27 years, and I said, you know, it's a most amazing place. I always travel on the underground. And, you know, there is a multicultural, wonderful group of people. And they're either going to work or they're going to play. And they try to make a living out of this amazing metropolis. And I don't see people knifing themselves. So why do we always get the bad news? I think if you can turn around. And, you know, the great thing about travelling on the underground is when it comes to a halt, you don't fall over because you're so squashed in. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place. Now, where are we? Yeah. Now, I just put a few of the letters after my name on this thing. I've got about 35 different ones. And in the height of my popularity, every university all the way around the world used to give me honorary doctorates, and I got these yards and yards. I gave up doing it recently because we've got some really funny universities these days, and I don't quite know what they do. I got my own bottle of water. It is not my computer, squirt, squirt. So let's get on with it. When moving around London, I liked, I'm going to say next slide, because that's how I was thinking. I don't understand these, so I say next slide and someone will do it, but don't go there yet, right? When moving around London, I like to travel on the underground. I call it my tube, because lots of people still like to chat with the man who they used to see on telly before he stopped his first wind farm on Blue Peter. I didn't really mean to do that, but it didn't half stop, and it started stirring up a lot. And I do wonder, is it that Teletubbies advertise wind turbines every time they put it on? Beep, boop, boop, and they fall around the wind turbine going around. Subliminally, of course. And I'd love to know who actually put and why they put that wind turbine up there. Next slide, please. Now, over the recent months that I travelled the tube, we talk about lots and lots of things, but recently it's all been about wind turbines, and spiced with the fact that in a bid to earn greenie points, Marks and Spencer's announced a plan to source all its electricity from renewables. Wow. The next step, Npower, which is a beloved thing by Greenpeace. They absolutely love it, despite the fact not only they make wind farms, but they also do all the nuclear power. And so Marks and Sparks were going to get all their stuff on renewables. Now, a quick sum showed that this would be about a third of the entire current annual output of Britain's 2000 400 winter pine, just to keep Mark's knickers up. Next slide. Oh, no, no, we've got it. That's Marks and Sparks. I'll show you something if you like. So what about the other green customers that have been led to believe that they are paying premium prices for supplies from the same pool of alternatives, let alone the ordinary customer who Ofgem admits is also paying an annual premium to help finance the same green electricity? As I say, a great way for Marks and Smiths and Sparks to greenwash their underpants, unless Npower is providing lots more new pylons and overhead wires to facilitate dedicated hookups, which they can't do and they don't do. So how happy are their customers when they find out that in reality their lean green electricity is mixed with 95% of juice made up of dirty carbon and nuclear, thanks to the fact that it all comes out through the same grid, and it doesn't do that grid very much good because it fluctuates the whole time. Now, of course, the same is true for RSPB, that's Royal Society of Protection of Birds Energy, whose large flock of fundraisers, 102 of them, are crowing about in their latest advert. What a total scam. Now, surely that tells us that our people in charge of this country get so many ideas wrong that we can just shut up and go home or get on living in a better way. The next slide, please. To cap it all, the brown job. In his guise as Capability Green, has announced that part of his plan to solve both the carbon and the credit crunch, Britain will create lots and lots of jobs by manufacturing and subsidising the use of electric cars. The next slide, please. And there's one of them. Doesn't his advisers know that they will all depend on plugging into the same national grid? Yet this man stood up and said, that's how I'm going to solve these problems. I didn't hear any moans or anything. We are being lied to the whole time. Now, with spin like that, there's little wonder that thousands of communities across Britain, Europe and the world are being torn asunder by wind-driven uncivil wars as long-term neighbours and friends find themselves on different side of a bitter cash flow argument. We're surrounded them. They are going up all the time. But there is some good news. In fact, the only good news about wind turbines is that the tide is beginning to turn very rapidly. Investment in these high-rise weapons of mass economic and social destruction has dropped dramatically, while the wind industry has just accused the government of sabotage over a proposed fourfold tax increase that could lead to the scrapping of up to half of Britain's 150 onshore projects. Wow! Was that all over the paper? Did the BBC tell? Did they hell? They held those facts back. Next slide, please. So, back to the drawing board and the underground. I really do like the underground. The sustainability of the underground's engineering heritage is second to none in the annals of public transport. And at night, its tunnels provided a safe night's sleep for my family and many others during the Blitz in London. We went down the underground and slept on the thing. And we always wondered, as kids, what would happen if a train came through when we were actually lying on the rails, but it never actually did. Today, its cultural diversity is immense. People of every creed and kind, backed by the economics of the oyster dance. And see, when they go through and put in their oyster card and get, ooh, wow, fantastic stuff. Are doing their best to travel to work or play below an amazing diversity of real estate. And quite a lot of that is empty and really does need looking and putting back into some sort of order before we start building and covering more and more of the green space we've got with useless buildings. Homo sapiens var urbanicus, living at a density of around 5,000 people per square metre across Greater London, while doing their best to make a living from this fossil fuel metropolis, a city paved with with gold for some and hope for all would-be Boris Whittington, and you've seen him parading round. Could he really help us if he came on our side? I don't know. But why are we really here today? The next slide. Call it creation or evolution, we are here because the gravitational forces that made Isaac Newton sit up and think, it was a big apple that fell on his hand, about that big, we've got some of them, not the original one, but we found out what they look like. And the sunspot, and the moving sunspots that nearly got Galileo recycled as biomass, governs the shape and the form of this universe. Once released from the crushing bondage of a granddaddy of a black hole by a big bang, these forces gave order to the universe that contains our lonely planet. Well, it was lonely. Indeed, it was dead until carbon found itself in orbit around the sun that regulates the Earth's heating and cooling system. Nothing else does it. It's the sun. Despite the fact that this, our spaceship, hurtles around the solar system at a speed of about 108,000 kilometres an hour, and its crust is made of slightly acidic aluminium silicate, a poison. We have to call it home because it's the only one we've got, and we should be looking after it, and we should be telling all the kids in this world we live in a wonderful world, and if you look after it, it's going to go on being wonderful for a long, long time. Next slide. Just to show how there were three generations of the kids who've never seen David Bellamy on Blue Peter. But I still go around and talk to lots of kids. And I had about 1,000 primary school kids. And all their teachers said, oh, we grew up on television with David Bellamy. And they showed pictures and things. And in the question time, a little girl put her hand up and she said, are you the voice on the Ribena advert? I say 4 words on that advert. And I said, yes. And she said, what made you say so famous that it will pay you lots of money to do that advert? What's wrong with our education system down there at that thing? Absolutely wonderful. Next slide, please. The only reason we and the rest of life can thrive here is because the temperature range at the surface of that oblate spheroid allows water, the universal catalyst, and the main greenhouse gas, and thousands of kids at this moment are filling the tick boxes on GCE, and they have to put carbon dioxide. It isn't. They have to lie every time they tick that tick box, and if they don't put, and if they had the audacity to put water vapor, then they would lose that point. From that point onwards, natural history, or in modern speech, biodiversity had to happen. I like the first term because it's dynamic, describing an ever-changing process. But as the latter is now politically correct, I and you are gagged with it. What a useless term, biodiversity. I'll tell you why. Next slide, please. The most biodiverse bit of London happens to be Kew Gardens. And its only drawback is that lots of fossil fuel has to be burned to maintain its environment status quo. That is warm, damp, and shady enough to bring on the flowers and the tourist smiles. I must say miles these days, I say. Tourist smiles, but not miles, because people damn well have to get there. And I hope not they go on getting there. If that source of energy was shut off, slowly but surely, the whole area would revert to a range of temperate estuarine wetlands, scrublands, and woodlands, as would the majority of the London Basin. And we do have to remember that the London bases and Stirling rising up after the effect of global warming. Hooray, hooray. If it hadn't, we'd be in real problems. Next slide, please. Now, each one of these ecosystems, and we don't use that term anymore, is buzzing with its own brand of natural history, programmed by landform and the prevailing state of the cycles of natural climate change. They're there, and they are holding the thing in some form of kilter. With all this recent talk about fuel security, are you all really sitting comfortably? Do you understand what that is and who is actually organising? If we'd been here just, indeed, anywhere in Britain, a mere 10,000 years ago, caves would have been at a premium and any real estate battles would have been fought using state-of-the-art chips made of flint, not of anything else. Very interesting, about 2 weeks ago, no, about a month ago, they found that people had been building houses in Scotland 14,000 years ago. How the hell they did, I don't know, because most of that was under ice, but the proof is there, and they were butchering reindeer, giant elk, and all sorts of wonderful things. And I was talking to a building firm, and all I could do was talk about that, and they didn't think it was very funny. The next slide. The last ice age was drawing to a close thanks to wobbly orbits and warmer phases of sun cycles. These were doing their best to remove the burden of ice off the land and refill the English Channel, thus providing Britain with the privileges and the problems of island status. Say it hadn't have filled up again. We'd have been part of Europe years ago. Well, we were before that. Thank God it did come and fill the thing up. The next slide. Now, all these slides, I once went from the North Pole all the way down into America, making a film called Bellamy's New World. And I took these pictures to show what the whole of Britain was like as it came out of the last, or was it, ice age. And we hadn't the faintest idea whether it was or not. Glaciers began to melt in earnest, and life began to appear in the meltwater. Now, this is all fact which have been looked at time and time and time again in peer-reviewed journals. The BBC don't take any of this as any fact at all. You have to have models made on computers. The next slide, please. And this was the first carbon footprint on those ices. It's called Chlamydomonas nivea. Now, anyone who did biology at O level when, well, it was a trick when I did it a long time ago, would know about Chlamydomonas. It's a wonderful little round cell. Really, it's a plant, but it hadn't quite made up its mind. It can swim, it can have sex. And living up there on the pristine snow cover, it has to protect itself with a red pigment, because as nascent hydrogen is produced, in fact, as chlorophyll is being formed, and if you get too much UV, then it just doesn't get formed. And as these things, therefore, because darker it melts the snow, and you get these little tiny footprints, each one with tens of thousands of these wonderful, jolly little Chlamydomonas nivea. Now, this is actually just round the corner, or happened just round the corner, where I live up on top of the Pennines. Two glaciers, one which was coming down from Teesdale, and the other one which had come all the way round across Shapfell, round across the motorway, and they bumped in together at this point. And as they bumped in together, they pushed an enormous lump of ice down into the thing to form a kettle hole. And we have looked in that, and we've got a complete pollen record of everything which happened in about the last 7,000 years. And we've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of those. And we know how much the temperature went up, well, relatively, and how much the other things changed. But during the formation of glaciers, it was very, very dry. Do you remember 17,500 years ago, if we'd have been in the Amazon, there was no Amazon forest there at all. It was very, very dry during the time we were having the Ice Age. And at some point, all the people there were, a million people probably living there, suddenly said, where the hell are all these trees coming from? And there wasn't a David Bellamy to tell them, because I, you know, and they had to put up with that and change their whole way of life. And again, we don't teach these things anymore at school. That is left out very, very well. I'm sure it's not because they don't want them to know, but there's so much other crap they make them learn these also about them. It just doesn't get in. So all these winds deposited lots of nasty, dirty dust. Do you remember Snoopy when he said, never, when you're skiing, never eat yellow snow? Well, when you go anywhere in Europe and there's lots of yellow snow, and yellow makes the thing melt quicker, and black dust as well. And if you go up into the two or three cantons where they don't have cars going backwards, pouring out, and lorries pouring out particular diesel, the blooming things are not melting. And do remember, it wasn't very long ago that they found the Iceman. And this Iceman had suddenly popped out of the melting thing, and there he was, and everyone took him home and sort of found out what he was. And that meant that he must have been going along somewhere hunting, and then he died. Up went the snow, and then because of natural cycles of warmth, out he popped again. And that all over the time, wherever we look. And in the old days, it used to be, it would be in the papers and things. We don't get those things in the papers, not as regularly as we used to. So here we've got two enormous glaciers pushing themselves down. And next slide, please. Now, the main problem which held up evolution or held up development was the fact that nitrogen is very, very soluble. So despite there was quite a lot of nitrogen there, and as the melting of the ice went on, it all got washed away. So the process of recovering of the landscapes would have taken much, much longer, but for the fact, and you see here, there is two pools, little tiny pools, and round the corner there is that black. Is another alga, a blue-green alga. And this amazing alga can actually fit, not only do photosynthesize, which is very clever, but also can fix nitrogen from the atmosphere. So they were pumping in the most important resource they actually needed. And from that point onwards, as good old hooray for glacier forming, as the temperature went up, and the permafrost began to melt, there was everything, and it was all systems go to cover the land very, very rapidly with plants. The only problem was the wind was still very, very dry, and so the only place other plants could get their roots down there was where there was some form of a shelter. And these are the famous stone stripes. And down just a little depression, the melting went very fast. And here are six species of mosses beginning to grow. And do remember, the mosses were the first land plant ever to be stupid enough to stick their head up above the water. And they've been there for 475 million years, a long, long time ago. Right, now these I love, these are ice ridge polygons, and you can fly across much of northern Canada, and there's this wonderful patterning underneath, and it's because as it melts and goes, and it does melt every summer, it melts a bit and then it freezes again. And we all get out there and we have people going out and say, my God, it's global warming going to melt all the things. Come back. I mean, the whole summer lasts about 10 days, but when you get there, you get your feet wet. You say, oh my God, it's all melting away. And if you look around each one of these ice wedge polygons, you'll see that black line, which is the blue-green alga, fixing the nitrogen, and the plants following on very, very rapidly. Next slide, please. Very, very soon, the terrain was rich enough to actually start to support lots of animals, and quite large animals. And here is a kill, which was made a long, long time ago. And round it, because of the nutrient which has come out of the dead animal, there are now 9 species of moss and 3 species of flowering plant, beginning to make soil. So as soon as global warming, natural climate change, what you enjoy, it got better and better and better. And we've got to remember that in those 10,000 years, most of the civilizations of the world developed. Now, what the hell would have happened if climate change hadn't warmed it up? We'd still be in a pretty bad state down there, but it didn't. So I always say thank God for global warming, but the natural stuff, not BBC Mark 1 stuff. Next slide. And here's absolutely wonderful, because now most of the frozen ground has gone, and you can see the trees starting to come in and grow round the edges of those ice wedge polygons. And here we've got it. The whole landscape is being gobbled up by plants and even by trees. And it wasn't long after the melting started that the trees were actually growing. Next slide, please. Until we find that the whole of Britain 8,000 years ago would have been covered with deciduous old growth forests. It must have been the most boring, bloody place to try and live anywhere. I'd have loved to have seen it, don't get me wrong, old growth forest. But how could anyone do anything in it? And thank goodness, wandering farmers turned up on the scene with, and they were stuck until they could actually find a stone which they could polish and turn into axes. The next slide, please. And here is the first Neolithic farm. I couldn't find a real one, so that. And this is, I took a group of Boy Scouts about 35 years ago to Spain, and we looked at the vegetation going from right under the sea, right to the top of the Sierra Cabrera. And when we got to this tiny little village, it had not changed at all since medieval times. And there was 2 blind ladies in the village, and their job was to strip elm leaves off every year to feed the animals. We thought that had all disappeared, and we went in and we actually saw it going. And thank goodness we got there just in time. They were about to chop down the last bit of this forest, and the Boy Scouts were all lined up, dib, 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 dob, 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 and we stopped it. But it wasn't that easy. But the next time we went back, television was there in a big way. Probably they could blame it because they had copies of my damn film I made of it, and off they went. Now, anyone who knows the Lake District, you should know that's the Langdale Pikes. And it was the Langdale Pikes where they found a rock formation which they could polish and turn into axes. And these axes were then flogged all the way around Northern Europe, and they were the things which allowed the Neolithic farmers to chop down the elm trees and also the oak trees. And wow, they put biodiversity in it. And if you think about it, all the fields, all the wetlands, and most of the other things which we say is the British landscape, a landscape which Winston Churchill said was worth dying for. You go, I can remember him, I sat with a cat's whisker at home during the war, and we heard that great man saying all those amazing, amazing things. A landscape which is worth dying for. And when he was actually in charge of Chequers, he revamped the whole of the Chequers' main garden to attract butterflies and bees and things. And I'll be told that in the history that we get from is all the bad stuff, never the good stuff. The next slide, please. There's the axes, and even that, it didn't take very, very long. In fact, scientists have made the axes again and seen how long it would take to chop a tree down. Next slide. Now, when the Romans sailed up the Thames and founded Londinium, there was little left of Britain's ancient forest, even north of the Hadrian's Wall. They went through it. They were, you know, and there was probably very, very little of old-growth forest left anywhere, by the time the Romans got there. Next slide. And that was the same Hadrian who banned mixed bathing in the sumptuous baths built in what then became the City of London. Do you remember they found it about 15 years ago? And this wonderful place where he banned mixed bathing because rude things were happening. And what did we do? We turned it into a bloody high-rise parking lot. Why didn't we open a brothel and see how... And also, by that time, they were doing good red wine on the Scottish borders. And the temperature must have been 3 degrees warmer than it is now. And we've got all these records. And all the ones which Al Gore and show you know, all the real ones go down. I'll talk about that in a minute. The next slide, please. Now, the medieval warm period saw the golden days of European organic agriculture. The growing world population could be fed and civilization flourished, creating some of the world's greatest buildings, sculpture and music. I remember walking with my eldest grandson through, where was it? Well, it was in Italy, and he was going to, and we'd shown you all these beautiful buildings. And he said, you know, Granddad, if we hadn't have built those things, we wouldn't have to waste so much money looking after them, would we? Which I think that was pretty terrible. And Granddad had to, I didn't hit him, but I felt like he did. And we also got to remember that at that time, the Vikings had colonised the ice-free margins of Greenland, farming cereals, sheep and beef, but not for long. The temperatures dropped again, heralding the Little Ice Age, which lasted for a long time. Next slide, please. As the temperature eased downwards, crops failed and thousands died of malaria. They called it ague in those days, but it was malaria. A disease, and note this, which was endemic throughout Europe and way up into Siberia. So how the hell can the global warmers say, oh, we're all going to die of the global warming because we're all going to get malaria. It's lies. It whole pages and pages and pages of lies. So what was happening then, people were not, they were bad crops right the way throughout the Little Ice Age, and people just didn't have enough to eat, so they succumbed to the ague. You know, it's not really a killer, well, some strains are killers, but they just didn't have enough food, and when you have enough food, or the right, as we were shown yesterday in that wonderful thing about the changing of our food these days, they began to die. The only thing that then brought some cheer into a very, very cold Europe, and very, very cold, much colder world in some ways, were the ice fairs on London. This was a picture of the last one. This was the coming into the end of the Little Ice Age, and things were beginning to warm up again. And do remember, 1850 was the time it started warming up, and that's where all the global warmers start their gas from, not earlier at all. So they miss out the hump. Now, corroborative proof of much of this sequence I've been talking about, of landscape and natural climate change, came by accident while building a bypass around Darlington. And we were called in there because one of their big dog diggers had disappeared down a hole, and it was an old kettle hole. And we climbed into this, we got Blaster Bates in, and he just put a charge of dynamite and blew the thing back out, and it stood on the side again. That was good fun. But then we looked at this, and there was a complete, well, not a complete record, but all these changes. And at the bottom, I could pick up handfuls of those five mosses which started the process off 10,000 years ago. And people say, oh, no, no, you've got to prove it with a, you know, Right, now how, so the record was preserved by the peat, backed up by many other base, peat-based sequences, studied across Britain, across Europe, and across in parts of the world. And they show that climate change was the culprit, and it was nothing else but change. Now, how can I say, dare to say that, when the media is still making a meal of Al Gore's predictions of a melting world, let alone an Oscar and a Nobel Prize? How did they ever give Henry Kissinger a Nobel Prize? How the hell did they give Al Gore a Nobel Prize? But they got it, and they're still going around the bar talking about it. Next slide, please. Well, here's the temperature level, the real record. There's the medieval warm period, then into the Ice Age, up and down, and we're still not back to the medieval warm period. And we're wobbling about like the clapper. So how can we say that carbon dioxide is in the driving seat? The next slide, please. And how about this one? Peer-reviewed many times. Here is the shortening, the melting of our glaciers. And you see it starts, here we're coming out of the Little Ice Age down and then back. And the trend of melting had not changed at all. Despite that we're pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, the actual trend doesn't change. So how can carbon be the driving force? It can't be the driving force. Next slide, please. Now, here is Al Gore's famous hockey stick. And we've all seen it. We've even seen David Attenborough with his own hockey stick hobbling about the thing saying, oh, it's all because of global warming. I don't know why he ever said that. He used to be on our side, but he changed for some totally unknown reason at the same time that he pushed for an enormous wind turbine on Glyndebourne. And why did he want a thing? Because every place that you have a opera, they like to be the best in the world. And he could do Don Quixote. Clever stuff, isn't it? With the bloody wind, well, they could turn it off, couldn't they? But there is the hockey stick. And now let's look at the actual figures. I'll get you The real official data from the Met Office Hadley Institute, no less, recalled a very different picture. Next slide, please. A flaccid hockey stick that needs a bloody good dose of Viagra. No wonder, and we weren't told this by the BBC, but no wonder that after its statistical invalidity had been exposed to the world, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change strategically moved it out of public view. It disappeared from that big thing, and they haven't talked about it yet. Yet, next slide, David Miliband, one of the terrible twins, ordered that copies of all Al Gore's shockaholic movie, the backbone of which is the discredited hockey stick, should be given to all secondary schools. Wow. Another inconvenient truth arrived when a British High Court judge ruled that as five of the claims made in the film were so scientifically absurd that the government would be in breach of a law against the teaching of propaganda in schools. And unless the film was accompanied by counterweight material correcting its errors. There were 25 lies in there, but the High Court didn't really say what five will do. The only problem was that nobody told the teaching profession of this law. And that I wonder how many teachers there are who could be going to prison because of going against that law, but they weren't actually told. Right, we must thank our lucky star, the sun, that not long ago all human aspirations were solar powered. We must also thank God or Richard Dawkins that humanity is set aside from the rest of biodiversity by one sole attribute, the power of conscious thought, knowledge of right or wrong, ethics, soulship, corporate responsibility, call it what you will. We alone can learn from history, be it natural or people-made, and put the things of good report into action. Wow! That's why you're here. You've got the guts to stand up and say the time has come to stop. Please, I'm not saying that we all must become subsistence farmers and fishers. Far from it. I'm cautioning that the state of the human-driven world is already facing its most debilitating problems, an increasing population and the biodiversity crunch. We have got to stop the biodiversity crunch. Without a well-planned surface network of natural areas and a well-planned matrix of green corridors for migration, the cost of future management will escalate out of control. That is the problem facing our thing. And there are very, very good things coming through. The good news is that every which way I look around the world, I find people fed up and sick and tired that the values and the everyday things their parents and grandparents took for granted are disappearing before their very eyes. The even greater news is they are not just sitting back and expecting that the government will solve it, because they know it won't, but they're working with their local communities to stitch their patch back into more biodiverse and hence more sustainable working order. And it's happening. I could take you and make a good news story from around the world every day. For those who would still question my scepticism about man-made global warming, I will remind you of the following facts. As the world got ready to welcome the new millennium in, the Y2 bug scare caused, and note this, tens of thousands of the world's most highly paid and computer literate people to succumb to a mass hysteria that would cost them dearly. 70 days later, another bout of mass hysteria birthed the dot-com bubble with much gnashing of golden teeth. Almost a decade later, the next real bout of "we are doing our best to increase our profitability" hysteria crunched the world's credit, setting our biggest money lenders all of a twitter about their new year bonuses. And look what a hell of a mess that has actually got us. Add to that the fact that despite more and more carbon dioxide has been pouring into the atmosphere over the same decade, the world's temperature has not risen at all. Indeed, over the past 2 years, the temperature has begun to fall. The main scientific explanation for this is lack of sunspots. If you actually look, we are now into the 24th cycle of sunspots. There have been no sunspots for 18 months. The last time that happened, we went into the Maunder minimum and the Thames froze over. So why aren't these? Why do, whenever I hear the BBC talking about Africa, they say all the African lakes are drying up because of global warming. They're drying up because we're using all the water out of them for growing cut flower for Tesco's or Marks and Sparks, all those things. I mean, the biggest boo-boo in the Al Gore film was that he said, which was it, the Aral Sea had dried up because of global warming. Everyone knows that the Aral Sea had grown up because the great presidium of science of all Russia were asked, where shall we grow our cotton? And it was the perfect place. But it had, for every ton of cotton, it uses 19 tons of water. And that's gone. And now they found, just round the corner, another enormous lake nobody knew was there, and all the water's painted that. Why aren't we told that? Why aren't we given the really good news that we should be given? Next slide, please. Now here I must go down on my knees, and it's difficult getting back up and say, I have been a petrol head all my life. In fact, the press call me the Lamborghini. So when I was interviewed 18 months ago by the media at the unveiling of Honda's Formula One car, the Earth car, it was absolute rubbish, it didn't go at all. But I was there, and that funny man from, what's he called, he thinks he's about motor cars, Top Gear, like, he was there, he wouldn't speak to me. Because, of course, I am the president of the camping caravanning club, and he doesn't like... And I went up and I thanked him. He wouldn't listen. I said, thank you very much. To actually make them fall to pieces, you had pulled all the guts out the inside and then race them around the thigh. You had done the best advert for, camper vans. And he didn't think that was funny, but so... I'd like to go on the programme, because I have been a... I had my first motorbike when I was 11. And the police in London, you say, how's the bike going on, Dave? What would they say to me today? Probably, how's the bike going on, Dave? There's still some good ones there, yeah. So I intoned that Honda hopes that this magnificent machine is the most efficient one in the world to do the job it was built to do. There it is. The only thing green about it was it had no adverts on the front, and it had a picture of the world with all those fluffy, funny clouds. The bit the media latched onto was my statement that it was my considered opinion that Formula One racing is a better mother of invention than Tony Blair's next war. And I really shouldn't have said that, should I? But he got all over the press. Ladies and gentlemen, it is also my considered opinion that good science, good social science, and good civil engineering based on the common sense ethics of natural history, not boom and bust profit backed by badly researched politically targeted and a parcel of rogues with their snouts deep in the trough, can solve all environmental problems. We have got to reinvent truthful science. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we've got to do it. And I think if we could get a few of those scientists here who are frightened, you can't blame them for being frightened, to hear the cross-section of humanity in this room who really care and will back up, I think it could happen quite literally. So join the multicoloured Renaissance and help your communities to stitch their lives and their landscape back into more biodiverse working order. That is why we are gathered here today. But time to recall, time to recap, and also time to say no to the scam of capping carbon. Next slide. Back in the early 70s, I used to get my research papers on natural history and the balance of the biosphere regularly published in the journal Nature. I even made it onto the front cover of that august publication, the most important science papers in the world. And I was only the second person ever to go on that, the first being Charles Darwin. And wow! And when... And my dad even said, wow, when he saw me. Here is the front of the thing. Next slide, please. Nature, David Bellamy, girl with grass skirt, me with a lawnmower. That was on the front of Nature. They believed in me in those days. And the caption was, science is fun. My God, it used to be fun, didn't it? We used to hear about scientists doing things, solving problems, making it into a better world. Now the bastards aren't doing it. And there are so many who are so... I've got six very, very good. And they say, we'll give you all that, but don't ever mention our name. We couldn't put up with what was slung at us by our colleagues in Cambridge. Why? Why did it happen? So there you are. That was, I should have retired at that point. But I did make about 400 programs. And wasn't I lucky? I went around the world. I've probably been around over 200 times in my life. I've been one of those privileged people. I have a multicoloured part adopted family, and I've been married and happy for over 50 years. I mean, my God, you know, I've never done a day's work in my life. I mean, if coming in here and having the privilege of talking to you is work, may I say to everyone who's been scared by the global warming and wind farm dogma of the last 30 years, take heart. Earth's climate has remained within the limits tolerated by life for several billion years. During this time, the planet has experienced unimaginable volcanic events which liberated huge amounts of CO2. We have collided with extraterrestrial objects, which triggered either increase or decrease of temperature. And even the energy flow from the sun has altered over such a span of geological time. And yet, here we are. Life remains. The global temperature is well within life's limits. Indeed, the present day is cooler than much of previous geological time. The next slide, please. And there is the latest of the thing. It's not warming, it's cooling, and it's cooling exceedingly rapidly. Yes, in the past 7.5 years, rapid surface atmospheric cooling, especially in the northern hemisphere, has continued. Meanwhile, the BBC continues to preach the warmer's doom and gloom amongst nations. Our swallows were a fortnight late this year. Perhaps they've heard about RSPB energy. Ladies and gentlemen, wow!
David, thank you so much.
Just like the reasons behind the financial crisis, the invasion of Iraq, and the continued bloody occupation of Afghanistan, much of what we're being served up by the leaders of the Western world and mainstream media seems more like propaganda than balanced reporting. That was well-known man-made climate change skeptic who's been frozen out of the climate change debate, Professor David Bellamy. He was speaking at the Alternative View 2 conference in London earlier this year, and you can get this and other DVDs from www.ianrcrane.org.uk, and that's Ian R. Crane, C-R-A-N-E, ianrcrane.org.uk. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with our usual news review. If you want to listen again to that programme or any previous shows, you can do so by going to the BCFM website. That's bcfm.org.uk and clicking on Presenters on the right or Podcasts on the left to find my page. I'm Tony Gosling and I wish you a very good Christmas holiday and respite from the rat race.